From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is being made across the Rochester area, where faith leaders are having difficult conversations about race. The Greater Rochester Community of Churches Faith in Action Network has partnered with several local organizations and individuals to address systemic racism and talk about race relations with people from all walks of life. And one approach is a workshop called Racism and White Privilege 101. It's organized by Reverend William Wilkinson and Reverend Alan Daly, who lead conversations about white privilege, fragility, the impact of racist attitudes, and more. And we've had a number of conversations on this program about how to address difficult subjects like this. We found that regardless of the approach, the people leading those discussions are seeing results. And we've invited Reverend Wilkinson and Reverend Daly to join us today to talk about their ideas, their methods, and what they're hearing from participants throughout the community. We'll also talk about what they think about the role of faith-based communities in addressing these kinds of issues, especially in 2020. I'd like to welcome our guest this hour. Reverend Dr. William Wilkinson is pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Medina and a former board president of the Greater Rochester Community of Churches. Reverend, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And also with us is Reverend Alan Daly, who is interim pastor of the John Knox Church, Presbyterian Church in Greece. Also, interim executive director of the Greater Rochester Community of Churches. Did I have that correct?
You've got that correct.
You both have these long titles and, frankly, now a long relationship. When did you meet?
About 15 years ago.
Yes.
15 years ago. And tell me about that meeting.
Well, we met when we were both second career people in seminary. We met at Colgate Seminary. I was just getting ready to leave, and he was just coming and starting. And our paths have continued to cross several times since then through the Greater Rochester Community of Churches and some of the activities we've had. You might want to share some of the ones that you had.
Well, of course, Alan had been involved with Reverend Lewis Stewart and the United Christian Leadership Ministries, especially when they were working on the early days of the community police relationships. And he came into a meeting that I came into. I had met Lewis Stewart in one of his local community workshops with the police chief and people who had complaints to bring to the chief, and walked into a room, and there was Alan. And we knew right then that we'd been working in parallel paths. We needed to be working together on these issues.
And both of you, again, second career in the seminary.
Yes.
What sent you there, William? Tell us about that.
Well, I had been a physician in my former life and a sociology professor. I've been involved in the Black Studies movement in the late 60s. But I came to a point where instead of just working with things religious on Sundays, I really wanted to do this full time. And I felt the call from God, call from the church, and that inner pressure that this is really where I wanted to go with all the things that I had come to at that point in my life. Hmm. And Colgate Rochester, among the seminaries that I looked at, had the social gospel as a sort of a shining light. And I knew what they meant because I had been involved in social medicine. And, you know, for people in social medicine, all medicine is social medicine. For people in the social gospel, the whole gospel is social.
For some listeners, they will hear the term social gospel, and
yes,
they will assume you mean something necessarily political. Is it political to you?
Not at all. The understanding of the social gospel is that when, in the history of our faith, one talks about God and neighbor, that everything in the Bible that talks about living is about the relationship between all of us who are all belonging to God. And so that understanding, which really says that the purpose of religion is this life in the land of the living, loving each other in the land of the living, working out relationships in the land of the living, that I knew was the social gospel, and that's what it was when I got to the Hill.
Why do you think some people hear that and assume it's political?
People sometimes gets into the habit of defining religion according to their way of living in society, rather than letting religion determine how they actually relate to one another. And if you do that, then, of course, everything that's not the way you think of becomes political. For the people who believe in the social gospel, everything is religious. That is to say, spiritual, a part of our relationship with one another. And while we may fight around political things, the underlying thing is the value of us as connected folks.
Hmm. Reverend Daly, what brought you in a second career to the seminary?
Well, I'd felt a call to ministry when I was a teenager at Penfield High School, by the way. And I said no. There were too many things that I was uncomfortable with. And I said no for about 38 years. During that time, I spent most of my career in the consumer product sales and marketing business. And I felt, again, I kept feeling a call, and I found myself in a place where at about 56, that was the thing that I probably should do. I didn't know why I was going. I didn't want to be a pastor. So I went, but I went to Colgate. It was here, and it was convenient, and I went, not having any clear idea what to expect.
You're 56. You know you don't want to be a pastor, but you're going to go to Colgate anyway.
That's right. And so, but one of the things that happened was that I spent 38 years in sales and marketing. I go to seminary. I'm still in sales and marketing. And because that's what life's all about. But I just found that there was a whole rich area for me to continue to work in, and that pastoral ministry was really what I was being called to do. And I had just turned it down. So
it took you a while to figure that out.
It sure did.
But you figured it out. And you've had this friendship, but you've decided, I think, just for the last 3 years now, of offering this kind of a workshop. So let's talk about what the workshop actually is and how it came to be. And I'll start with Reverend Wilkinson. Tell us about how it came together here.
Well, this particular set of workshops grew out of work that we began in Greater Rochester Community of Churches, Faith and Action Network, that was stimulated by some questions from Reverend Dr. Wilfredo Baez. He's a Methodist pastor who was on our board, who, when he came onto the board as a Latinx person, he said, "So how many people of color are there on the board?" And we looked around. I looked at Wilfredo, and he looked at me. "So there's just two of us, right?" And so we began to say, if we're going to deal with racism, we need to begin to look at how we function. How mixed racially is our board? What are the issues that we're concerned with as an organization? And so as we began to look at ourselves, Alan and I said, okay, so as we're doing this, and we did make some changes in our board, we made our board more colorful, more rainbowish, we began to ask, now, what do we do? And one of our board members, Wilma Campbell, from the Society of Friends of Rochester, had just become involved with the film I Am Not a Racist, Am I? And the work that was going to be done in school systems with young kids. And she said, well, how can you guys support me? And I says, here's where we want to support you. We want to make your program our program. Whatever you're going to do, we're supporting that. And we'll go from there. And so out of that came the richness of her work with others in the schools, and the idea. And James Cohn, late Professor James Cohn from Union Seminary, had just written his book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree. And so together with Wilma, we pulled together a multiracial, multi-religious, and secular folks workshop looking at the history of lynching, looking at the film on history, and then looking at Cohn's book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree. And that really, after we did that successful sort of 7 weeks long workshop, we said, this has got to continue, but it needs to continue congregation by congregation and groups of congregations by that.
More than at any point in my adult lifetime, the last 2 to 3 years, we've heard conversations about representation on boards, in leadership, in corner offices. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so when you have that conversation several years ago and you say, well, how many people of color are on this board? It's just me and you. I assume, you know, much of your life as a person of color, you have been sort of alone or close to alone in leadership positions. But how much do you think others around you have been cognizant of that, and how much do you think that has changed?
I think that most people have been aware of it. Most often people have not seen it as their role to change that. Mm-hmm. But there's been a certain openness. You know, one of the gifts of the Northeast, we are not heaven. And we certainly have racism in our bones, in our institutions. But there's something in there that values the human spirit in the Northeast. There's something in our culture that if you could show me what I'm doing and it's really not the right thing, I can work with that. I can deal with that. There's always somebody in communities in the Northeast that are open to that. And so what we did was, with ourselves, ask our denominations, who all send members, Do you have members of color that might be a part? Do you have women that might be a part of this? And over the course of about 2 years, we really began to change the complexion of our board.
Hmm. Reverend Daly, for you, when these workshops began, what did you hope would come out of it? I want to ask you two questions for yourself and then also for people who participate.
For myself, I want to be able to touch people's lives, and that's a driving force for me. The work I do, I see there's a lot of need out there, and I want to be genuine in how I approach all the work I do and have people realize that, yes, I'm there to figure out a way to help improve your situation and your lot. And because that's one of the things that I found that I get out of the ministry that I had turned down for 40 years. And so that, I guess for me, it's just the ability to be able to see somebody smile and say, hey, you get it, because a lot of people don't get it for them. In terms of what I would hope for from them, one of the things I've come to realize around the work that I do is that it's really important for people to start to realize what they don't understand about racism. Thinking about racism and looking at it through white eyes, I see a very different picture. I and myself have seen a very different picture than William has seen it throughout his life, and I'm hopeful that I can help them start to understand some of those factors so that they can recognize that in themselves.
Do you have any early memories of your life when you were keenly aware of race and racism, or did it happen later for you?
I have some memories in my life. I didn't realize it at the time. And one of the memories I had was when I read the book, The Color of Law, mm-hmm. and they were talking about redlining, and they were talking about the fact that, the neighborhoods for the people of color and the poor neighborhoods and the neighborhoods of poverty were the ones on the other side of the tracks. And growing up here in Rochester, those neighborhoods were on the other side of the tracks. And it was going down Joseph Avenue and going down Clinton Avenue, and they were right on the other side of the tracks. And all of a sudden I realized that I was aware of it then, but I didn't recognize it then. Another memory I have is it was sometime during my teenage years. There was a book that was published. It was called Black Like Me, and it was about a man who had gone blackface and gone into a black neighborhood so that he could try to experience what it was like being black. And it was an interesting book for me to read because I gained perspectives on it. Now that I look at it, I often wonder how he would have reacted if he had known that he was not going to be able to go back to being white at some point in time.
That's a powerful question, I suppose. And frankly, the reason I ask about, you know, how early we had these first sort of experiences, sometimes viscerally, of what race and racism may be, is because we here at WXXI, we did a workshop with, I think it was led by Jackie Campbell. Mm-hmm. And she asked that question. And generally speaking, the white people in the room, their first thoughts about race really sort of formationally was older, maybe teenage years or even into adulthood, whereas people of color had experiences very early in life where they were painfully aware. Reverend Wilkinson, what about you? What's the earliest thoughts of race?
Well, of course, all my life I've had to deal with being mostly in a minority situation numerically. And all the kind of prejudice things that one goes through. But for me, the real critical experience that brings me to who I am today and what I do today was an opportunity internationally to go beyond the U.S. experience to see something in the human experience that it In our context, we call it racism, but it is just there universally. I was a medical student my last year, and I did a semester in community health in the rural areas at the medical school in Nairobi. And when we came back, we had finished our course. We were all happy, and we were having beers in this one restaurant. And the guys there were for all different ethnic groups in Kenya. So they started joshing each other. One said, "Oh, you're a Kikuyu. As soon as the baby comes out of the womb of a Kikuyu mother, the baby grabs for a piece of money. Oh, you're Abaluya. You guys don't circumcise, so you never become men. Oh, and you're Wakamba. All your women are prostitutes or soldiers," because the geography of the Wakamba people is that they were between the coast and the rich part, the Kikuyu lands of Kenya. And so the recruitment of soldiers was done amongst their people. And the women that they had sex with were from their people. So I said to myself, "Wait a minute, guys, I didn't come here from the United States to see about prejudice. I got plenty of back that home. We're all human beings, aren't we?" But what it taught me was that there's something in humanity which has tempted us to divide one another by our station in life, by our complexion, by our cultural manifestations, and that was the same thing that was happening with racism in the United States. And so when I engaged that, I really understood, just like I would be an African-American going to Kenya and seeing everybody's connected, I could see their connection when they couldn't see it. So I came home saying, "Oh, no, to do this work, we can't dehumanize the other person. We have to recognize their humanity and then look at the differences as human beings in mutuality."
So what you're describing, this tendency to draw these differences out and to divide ourselves, even jokingly, but sometimes not so jokingly, that is kind of at the core of some of what is driving, I think, fear of demographic change in this country.
Yes.
You know, and we're going to have, before long, if not now, I mean, I don't know what the numbers are today, but we're not far from a white plurality in this country. And, there are, whether it's political leaders or media commentators sort of preying on that fear of demographic change. And some of the people who sort of subscribe to that fear believe that we're just human beings are so naturally going to just divide ourselves that we'll never overcome that. Yeah. That is inherent in being alive and being a human being. That's sort of maybe a cynical view, but it animates a lot of the fear. What do you say about that?
Well, there are two things that really swim around. First, I go back to my faith roots, and understand that in our faith, the Abrahamic faiths, we talk about right relationship. And the whole concept of right relationship means we are in relationship with one another by God. That's the nature of ourselves as beings. And that relationship really should define everything. Well, there's a cultural concept that comes out of a lot of the Southern African tribal nations called Ubuntu. Now, this word Ubuntu that was made famous by Nelson Mandela and Bishop Tutu when they were in the days of consolidating the country of South Africa after freedom had come, they used this concept, which means I am because we are, and we are because I am. It was their way of saying what some of the Native Americans called Mitinyatu Koyasin. We are all relatives. This understanding that we're all relatives, even if we don't look the same, it undergirds our understanding in this approach to fighting racism. The accident of racism as a term forgets that we are the human race. Somebody the Pope in 1494, where the Europeans were fighting over the colonies and decided, "Oh, wait, all of you Europeans have the right to colonize indigenous peoples who are non-Christian." That concept was used to redefine something which was older and more deeply rooted. And it was then that the ship captains began to write differently in their logs about the Africans with whom they were trading. It used to be that, well, this is a wonderful people on the Gold Coast. They have this culture. And this. But after slavery began, they began to put these people down. They began to emphasize the negatives. So that this idea of us being different was something that we were civilized to believe, acculturated to believe. And, of course, the faith community, that's not what we say we believe. We say we're all gods. And so we use that concept of Ubuntu, our version of it in our faith is right relationship, to say, no, wait, we are all one. And if we are all one, that what is your problem is my problem. And then we can only solve it by working together on it.
And in a moment, we'll talk about the upcoming workshop that they have later this month. But Reverend Daly, how do you view that question that people have, that fear that might animate some of the kind of the unrest socially we have about this demographic change and this fear that we will always divide ourselves along differences?
I think that we always have a fear of the unknown, and the unknown is part of the difference piece. And there's, I think, also as whites, we have a fear of changing the status quo because we're the beneficiaries of the status quo. And I think that is a big piece of education and understanding that we have to bring into this conversation among ourselves, is that we are the ones that benefit from the status quo. As opposed to any other group at this point, unless you take yourself and put yourself in a group where you're in the minority and you realize that you don't have that control and that power.
We're talking to Reverend Alan Daly and Reverend Dr. William Wilkinson, a couple of friends, pastors, faith leaders in our local community. They met about 15 years ago when they were in seminary at Colgate-Crozier Rochester Divinity School, and it's a second career for them, but it has become obviously an animating passion in their lives, and several years ago they created this workshop. And there is another event coming up on Saturday, January 26th, so the last Saturday of this month. The event is called Racism and White Privilege 101. That event from 3 to 5 p.m. on Saturday, January 26th at the St. Anne's Catholic Church on Mount Hope. If you want to register and get involved, gentlemen, can the public still do that?
Yes. Yes.
How do they do that?
Again, let's see, I've got a...
By the way, as Reverend Daly pulls it up here, I'll let our listeners know. We'll make sure that we have it on our podcast page. It's a sort of a long URL. So the bottom line is, if you want to do it online, we will link to it for you. WXXINews.org/connections is where you can get all of the posted shows, the podcasts, and related notes. And later this afternoon, we'll make sure it's up there. Anything you want to add to that, Reverend Daly?
Okay. To register, visit Our Lady of Our of Lady of Our Lady of Lords, StAnne.org. Or contact John Capusta at area code 9. This is a cell phone, area code 914-456-1454. And I'll give this to you so you can get it posted.
So again, listeners, this workshop is open to the public. They'd love to see you there on Saturday, January 26th, 3 to 5 at St. Anne's Catholic Church on Mount Hope. And again, registration information will be posted on the podcast page for this show, WXXINews.org/connections, later this afternoon.
And there will be an informal meal to follow, and child care will be available.
Very good. Let me grab a phone call from Mike in Rochester first on the phone. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi. I'm a member of the Spiritus Christi Church, mm-hmm. and Reverend Moira over there has been doing great things with the Spark Committee.
Yes.
But I want to make a comment that, racially speaking, we went on a trip 2 years ago around Easter time. It was a civil rights tour down south, mm-hmm. and I think we parked at the church. And our demographic was probably 50% white, 50% black, and it was the best way for people to understand that we're all really common. And I think those common experiences like that really break the our cultural norms, let's put it that way, or what we're used to.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike, thank you.
You know, we, Yeah, okay, I'll take the comment off the air.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate that. In fact, I think we talked about that trip on this program. So, Reverend Wilkinson, I'll start with you. What do you make of that comment?
It's a wonderful way for people to really get to know one another by sharing a common experience. And, of course, your bond, it can't be broken because you've seen people as in their fullness, in their full humanness. You've together looked at these historical things, and you've done it as one, so that whosever history you're looking at, you can all understand it and talk about it. You share meals over it. You fellowship, and you build that what we call right relationship with one another. It's just nothing like it.
Okay. Reverend Daly, go ahead.
Well, I think the opportunity that you have to get to know one another can't be beat. Because until you go out and intentionally make friends with one another and get to know each other, there will always be that divide and always be that unknown and always be a fear. And it's becoming friends and sharing ideas, and all of a sudden the things that you were important to you are important to the other person. And that's one of the things I've found as I've reached out to Reverend Stewart, William, a lot of my other African-American colleagues and friends, is that their agenda items have become mine, too, because they're important.
Right. Now, remember that Reverend Brown, for several years now, I know that part of her background is training with the Crossroads Anti-Racism in Chicago.
Sure.
She's been doing teaching for years at Spiritus Christi and out of Spiritus Christi, so that this wonderful experience that was had, it was something that came out of those sacred conversations that she's been having, the kind of conversations that we're hoping to have at St. Anne's.
All right, back to the phones we go. This is Howard in Rochester. Go ahead, Howard.
Hello, Evan, and hello, Reverend Wilkinson and Reverend Daly.
How are you, Howard?
How are you, Howard?
I'm good. Now, the show is advertised as part of your workshop is advertised as dealing with the impact of white supremacy and systemic racism. I haven't heard anything about that yet. I mean, the philosophical discussion, the altruistic discussion about us being one human family and all of that, that's good, and we need to know that, but we know that white supremacy and systemic racism manifest in gross inequities in the major areas of life, such as education, employment, housing, medical care, criminal justice, on and on and on.
Yes.
So I don't know if that's part of what you're trying to do, is get people to understand that in order to address those inequities, we're going to have to do work. They're not going to melt into oblivion. They were created by human beings, and they're going to have to be resolved or solved, or people like to say, we're going to eradicate racism, but I don't know how realistic that is. Yeah. So I'm not hearing that. I'm not hearing discussion about what systemic racism is and so forth.
Okay.
And the real impact of white supremacy.
Sure. Fair enough, Howard. As always, thank you very much for that. So let's hit that head on here. Systemic racism, white supremacy. Is it addressed in this workshop?
Yes. Well, you remember that I talked about the doctrine of discovery from 1494 and the way that religion was used to rationalize genocide and the taking of lands of indigenous peoples. In our workshop, we begin after we've gotten our covenant for the conversation that people who may or may not know one another before will be having. We begin with this whole history. We talk about the conquests of the New World, the so-called New World. We talk about slavery and the progression of slavery to Jim Crow and Jim Crow to mass incarceration. All those things are part of what we do to prepare for people to talk about the white fragility and white power. And of course, we define racism as privilege connected to power, but also then institutionalized. It's not just sort of isolated privilege and power, but it's also the institutionalization of that.
Okay, Reverend Daly?
part of the thing people have to realize is that the message that is needed in this workshop that goes to our black participants, our participants of people of color, is very different than what the white audience has to hear. And one of the things that the white audience has to hear is they have to start to understand definitions of some of these terms, because their expectations are very different than Williams or anybody else's. They have to understand the history. I know the first time I sat through a timeline of the history from the 1400s right up through now, I said, you know, this is a history that I've never heard, the history of the black history here. And these were terms, this was concepts that I was never even aware of. They were never in any of my history books. So part of our workshop for the white audience is to help them to understand some of the black experience. And that's, I think, one of the key benefits for us. We also tell our participants that, you know, what we're going to be doing here today isn't necessarily going to lead to you making a decision to start doing this. It's a planting of a seed. This is built and this is developed over a long period of time, and you can expect and accept non-closure on a lot of these issues coming out of this workshop. If we can stimulate some individuals to go out and continue to think about it, to continue to go to workshops, to continue to start conversations in their communities, that's what we're trying to do.
So after the sort of getting to know you, the covenant, and the definitions part of the workshop, we get into the ways that people in our local areas have been struggling with this. We talk about the organization that was known as FREE, Facing Racism, Embracing Equity, the Frederick Douglass Center, and other kinds of activity that are going on to really try to grapple with these in a practical way. The offshoot of the workshop, of course, is that we want people to reflect on this stuff and then to get involved actively, just as Howard Eagle was talking about, to move against racism.
Yeah, to Howard's point, and we're running up late for our only break here, but this is what I want to hit next here. When Howard brings up the term, as your workshop does, white supremacy, when that term comes up on this program, I have seen a wide range of reactions, but it is a sure bet with some segment of the listening population to shut people down. Some white listeners hear white supremacy and they think, you're talking about the Ku Klux Klan. You're talking about people in white hoods. You're not talking about the fact, you know, that's that narrow view of what white supremacy is, is how some people, so when they hear white supremacy, they shut down. They think, well, I'm not participating in that. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, trying to listen slowly, carefully over the years and recognize, again, all of the advantages built in society for people like me, you know, if there's a job open and a person with the name Evan Dawson applies and a person with the name Jamal Jackson applies and we have the exact same resume, who gets the call first? The person with my name does. Yeah. That is a sort of a product of white supremacy. Yeah. If someone with my male pattern baldness, white person's hairline goes out for a job and someone with what we would call dreadlocks or whatever, you know, natural hair goes out for a job, there's an advantage for the person with the white-centric hair. That, and so all of those things, and those are small, and I'm sure Howard is listening to this going, you got to talk about education, you got to talk, but all of those things are part of what I think we would define as white supremacy. However, just that term alone, some people shut down and they say, baloney. White supremacy is, I'm not a white supremacist, how dare you? And I want to know how both of our guests address people who shut down at just that notion. So let's get our only break, and they are going to tackle that after our only break of the hour. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about the split in the Methodist Church over same-sex marriage and gay ordination. The Methodist Church has wrestled with this issue for years, and now an international debate has forced the issue. And the International Conference last week produced a proposal to split the church in two, a traditionalist church and a more progressive one. We'll talk to leaders on both sides next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So, Reverend Dr. Wilkinson, let's start with you on this. You're going to inevitably have people at these workshops who bristle at even some of the terminology, privilege, advantage, and especially white supremacy. Yeah. How do you try to reach across and help them see things the way you'd like them to?
Well, of course, the first an important happening in our workshop is the establishing of a covenant. Now, when we use the word covenant, of course, it's biblically based, and it really has to do with underscoring this eternal right relationship, connection, interconnection between all of us. And so in establishing a covenant, that is to say, the ground rules for our conversations, one of the first principles is the principle of respect, that nothing that is said is supposed to be designed to dehumanize the other or to say that the other is wrong or right. And another aspect of that is the commitment to listen and then the commitment to not judge. Once you have respect, listening, and non-judgment, then people can react to terms. They can be comfortable, uncomfortable. And also one of the things we say is that the safe space of the conversation is not a space where you won't be irritated or even perhaps upset, but it's a place where everyone is kept safe in the discomfort of this very sacred conversation. Now, one of the things you talked about was the difference you alluded to, the difference between white nationalism or white extremism and the simple idea of supremacy by a system that has been designed to put people who have lighter skins or what's so-called white skin on top. This is why important in our workshop is the beginning with the history, the doctrine of discovery, the origins of what is defined as citizenship in this country, in our documents saying that only white people can be citizens of this country. People may not realize as we start our workshops that those are the ground rules of the United States of America. Reminding folks that all of us come from indigenous peoples, if you go far enough back, whether it's Europe, Africa, Latin America, and so that all of us have been squeezed into a framework of white and black, light and dark. It doesn't mean that any of us are actually white or black, but this white supremacist institutional system, which is different than people who are particular political views, is the context in which we all live. Some people call it the center or the periphery. And if someone begins to have problems with the word white, I'll remind them, okay, so I'm talking about the in-group and the out-group, and that there are characteristics that people have defined as the good or the in-group and the bad or the out-group, and we can begin that conversation. Always understanding that I'm not trying to change you. We're really trying to just tease out and parse out what is our common reality.
Hmm. Reverend Dale?
Well, one of the things that I generally try to do in the workshop and that I've heard is that a lot of white folks tend to take that term white supremacy personally, and it's not about them. It's about part of it is about the, as William said, it's about the system that's been set up to benefit and favor people that are white. And so knowing that, part of our task is to work with our brothers and sisters of color to help work to change the system in whatever ways we can do it. And there's a lot of opportunities to work on it, but we've got to be willing to do that and take that task on. And I think that's where we start working in the workshop to realize that this isn't about a personal thing about you or me or something that we personally do. It's about a system that we've got to figure out how we can make some changes in to move forward with it.
Reverend Daly, what do you say to a white participant in your workshop who says, I grew up poor with a single mother. I had an incarcerated parent. We struggled. We were on public assistance. I didn't feel any of the advantages you're telling me I had. Don't tell me about privilege. What do you say to that?
One of the things I could say to him is that I could go through a number of things that where he has benefited just because he's white. But one of the things I also say is that, and this comes from a quote that I read from Leonard Pitts once that really was powerful for me in terms of the work that I'm doing, is, you know, he said that, you know, white folks will never know as much about being black as a black person does, but counter as intuitive as it may seem, their voices carry on matters of race where a black person's will not, because white people can't dismiss their advocacy as self-interest, so that if you recognize that these problems exist in our system, then you should be working on it to help change it too, because you'll benefit.
Okay, Reverend Wilkinson?
Well, there are two things that I like to pose for people. One of the things that I do in the workshop is ask people what their ethnic background is. And I ask, does anybody here have African ancestry? And maybe one or two people will have done their ancestry.com, and they'll say, I do. I have somebody who's from Nigeria, you know, like two generations ago. And I say, but weren't we all descended from Lucy in the Olduvai Gorge of Tanzania? Aren't we all
Australopithecus afarensis.
Aren't we all African in origin? So while people are wrestling with that, then I say, but remember that there is no real such thing as white people or black people or red people or yellow people. All of us have different ethnic backgrounds. I said, and if you look at the history of America, each of our background groups has faced terrific discrimination as they came to America. They've had to change their names. They've had to de-emphasize their skin color, de-emphasize their language. All of that is a part of the dynamic of white supremacy. That is to say, there's a mythical white, the people on the top, who have defined this for us, and we have been challenged to buy in. I said, when we talk about kinds of racism, one of the kinds of racism is individually mediated racism. Now, for the person who's so-called white, that means benefiting from those privileges, even if you don't know it, and doing those things which are based on that benefit and continue that benefit. For people of color, individually mediated racism is participating in that system. Classically, it could be the person who's lighter having an advantage and taking advantage over the person who's darker. But it goes beyond that. It goes beyond that. I'll give you an example from my own background. Pretty early in my life, I was finished with graduate school, and I had two roommates living in Boston, Massachusetts. One of them was the editor of the Northeastern University School newspaper. And they got the idea, why don't we publish student newspapers? And they wanted to get national funding for this. And they said, well, we can get funding from the Small Business Administration, well, because you're black and you could be our lead person for getting that funding. I says, okay, how would that look? And they talked to me about the Bay State Banner, the black newspaper for the city. If I had been the lead person and we got that funding, minority business funding, we would have put the Bay State Banner, the black newspaper, and all the people who work for it out of business. So in other words, for me to benefit, and I would have benefited, they were going to pay me $40,000 a year for life, $40,000 a year for my own publishing. All I had to do was to cancel out the black newspaper and all those 18 jobs. There, if I had done that, then I would have been an individually mediated racist, according to X. Kendi, who was here.
Ibram X. Kendi.
He said anybody can be a racist if you do things which reinforce the system of institutional racism.
So let me hit a point here that I was reading about in the Washington Post. They published an interview this past Friday with Jim Wallace, who the interview was titled, Are There Cracks in Trump's Evangelical Firewall? Jim Wallace hopes so. Again, not to make this too political, but we are at this time where there's a lot of analysis of what it means to be Christian in America, what evangelical means, why evangelicals tend to vote pretty monolithically, although, again, trying to suss out some of if there are fissures. It's interesting. And Wallace has a book out called Christ in Crisis, Why We Need to Reclaim Jesus. He argues that too many Christians have become disconnected from Jesus, are not standing and acting in his name with his values, action, and inspiration. Mm-hmm. And he targets the politicization of evangelicals in this country. Mm-hmm. Do you agree, Reverend Daly?
I agree with a lot of what Jim says. I do feel that the Christians in the United States have gone in a couple of different directions. Some follow what I might call the Christianity of the empire, and that happened at starting in 312 when Constantine declared Christianity the religion of the empire, and it started to grow. But then there's other groups that will say, well, we follow the Jesus of Nazareth, who was concerned about the poor, who was concerned about those who were the least, who were willing. He talked about taking the least important seat at the table. He talked about all these things of giving up your own identity for that cause. And I find that's where I come down on when I think about my religion and when I think about my Christianity, is around following the tenets and the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth.
Reverend Dr. Wilkinson?
One of the things that Jim Wallis has been saying for many years, and I'm sure he's saying it again in this book, is that nobody on any end of the political spectrum can claim the term evangelical
for themselves.
That's
exactly what he's saying, yeah.
Because evangelical means you're a believer in the good news. And the good news that Jesus was bringing was the good news that was there in the scriptures and scrolls that he read when he was a boy, that God is the God of all, and that the good news is that God is there for you, whether you're in the temple or whether you're outside the temple, that God is where you're at. And so on the one hand, I believe that Jim is saying, if you're a Christian, you're supposed to be evangelical, and it's not just on a political end of the political spectrum. But the other thing is that Jim is raising up this classic understanding that Khalil Gibran, the Lebanese Christian who wrote The Prophet, offered. He said in Lebanese Christianity, there's an old story about the two Jesus that meet in the hills of Lebanon in a garden once every 100 years. Jesus of the Christian is in the garden, and Jesus of Nazareth comes into the garden and says, "My brother," and they embrace and they talk all day. And near the end of the day, Jesus of Nazareth turns, and before he leaves, he says, "My dear brother, I love you so, but I do not know if we will ever agree." The problem with Christianity is that we have not made the decision to follow Jesus as much as make Jesus an idol. And in our work, we want to follow Jesus and hear that message that Jesus says in Matthew 25. He says to his followers, I love you. You have treated me so well. But how have we treated you well? We just come to know you. No, you have treated the least of these, my brethren, in a good way. And so you have treated me in a good way. He says, but you others, you have treated me so poorly. You didn't visit me in prison. You didn't feed me when I was hungry. But how did we do that? We have never done anything bad to you. But you did that to the least of these, my brethren. And that really is the critical piece here, that if we believe that people of faith, all faiths, and you can see this in the Charter of Compassion, really in their religion say that we're all brothers and sisters, but we don't live it. The call that we say in our workshops is, no, we've got to begin to live this and deal with the difficult conversations.
The workshop he's referring to is Racism and White Privilege 101. It is Saturday, January 26th, from 3 to 5 p.m. at St. Anne's Catholic Church on Mount Hope Avenue. You can still register. It's open to the public, and we will make sure that you've got registration information. We'll post it on essentially the podcast page for Connections. It's wxxinews.org/connections. Every show is posted usually the afternoon that it airs, and we'll have all the information there. So in our last 90 seconds or so, for a listener who is nowhere near on board with some of this messages, saying, look, I didn't create slavery. I didn't participate in those terrible systems. It's 2020. Stop bringing the ills of the past to me. Convince them to come to this workshop in 45 seconds.
Because we are all part of one another, faith communities are part of their larger communities, we're all called to deal with this issue of racism and the need for reconciliation that is all around us. And so it's not about guilt. It's about, if we acknowledge that we are together in community, then this is one of those issues, like mass incarceration as a particular aspect of how racism works, that we all must grapple with together. If we do that together, we will make progress in this. By acknowledging our relationship in the workshop, we're also committing ourselves as members of community to work together on this.
Okay, 45 seconds.
I would go to the fact that justice is something we all want. And so I'm going to use a quote from Ben Franklin, and which was, "Injustice will only be overcome when those who are affected, or those who are unaffected, are just as outraged as those who are affected." And that's what the white community has to get themselves to that point.
Reverend, we had a listener ask you to repeat the phone number if you want to register. Can you do that?
Yes, I can.
He can find it, and I'll ask him to read it twice if you want to call and register for the workshop. It's the last Saturday of this month, and the number to call is what?
1-914-456-1454.
Do it again.
1-914-456-1454, and it's John Kapusta.
Thank you, Reverend Dr. William Wilkinson. Thank you for taking the time. Nice to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. And
thank
our
you.
Thank to Reverend Alan Daly. Thank you, Reverend. More connections coming up, and we stay on, a subject of our faith community and, frankly, a split in the faith community over LGBTQ issues in the Methodist Church. That is next.